Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Tangential Banter. As always, I am Ben Mowell, and I'm here with my co-host, Jack Korsanowski.
Yeah, he is.
I realized as I was saying that the wording was like, I might not be Ben Mowell sometimes. So, no. Just Ben Mowell here, as always, hosting the podcast.
I like it.
All right, Jack. Well, we have a stacked lineup today full of some related topics. So why don't you get us started with an introduction here?
Sure. So the introductory topic, which we're thinking will lead to a somewhat planned series of tangents, but we'll see how things go.
Call it plangents.
Plangential banter.
Yes.
So the opening question is, isn't it unfortunate that much of our knowledge about human health is based on empirical data versus theoretical analysis? Or in other words, you know, how is the human body going to react to X? Well, we can't really tell. We don't really know. So we just have to kind of take a little bit and see what happens. And it's unfortunate that we don't have a better grasp on biology to where we can feel confident. Or at least, you know, I'm not a biologist. I'm not in the medical field, but it certainly feels that way. And I'm sure that what knowledge we do have confidence in has only been developed, not because somebody kind of, you know, did the math or did the biology and kind of predicted, hey, I bet if we do X, this is how the human body is going to react. I don't think that's where most of our knowledge comes from. Most of our knowledge comes from, hey, let's try this and see what happens. And that people have just been doing that for decades. And eventually we got a good grasp on it. Compare that to, I think, there have been some things in cosmology where at the time, like let's say in the 1930s, we didn't have the means to confirm some stuff about what's going on in the cosmos. But then people theorized that, hey, black holes should probably be a thing. And then when we had the means, we went out there and we discovered, yeah, black holes are a thing. We found some. You know, that's something where what I mean by theoretical analysis, where there was where somebody was able to interpret what data they had and predict something that had never been tried or really studied before. And then it was later confirmed. And I don't think there's a lot of that going on with human health. A lot of it is, well, let's just try this out and see what happens.
The classic F around and find out situation.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you'd think with science being how advanced it is that we'd have a better grasp on how this stuff works.
Yeah. You know, I was having a conversation with a couple of coworkers, I don't know, the past few weeks. Are you familiar with the George Box quote, where he says all models are wrong, but some are useful?
No.
So he was a British statistician.
British.
Do you have an option on there for like some sort of a fish and chips joke or something on your soundboard?
I could add it, but not right now.
Okay. So anyway, the point he was making is that as we try to understand the world around us, we're constantly approximating. We're never actually like perfectly describing the fundamental laws of the universe. We're creating approximations that match as closely as possible with our current data and capabilities, exactly to the point that you mentioned.
Yep.
But that also we can't allow this pursuit of a perfect ideal model or theory to prevent us from making decisions based on the information that we have, imperfect as it might be. And so there's, whenever you're trying to develop a theory that can explain something more than just based on empirical observation to be predictive, you're constantly in this tension of is my model accurate enough to be useful in predicting future or unknown scenarios? And how useful does it need to be for us to get value out of it? So I feel like that's not just for healthcare, but really all science is kind of in a similar boat. Because what I ended up saying in that conversation was not that all models are wrong, some are useful. I said all science is wrong, some is useful. And just meaning that there's no, because science is a process, there's no completed state. Our knowledge is continually growing, improving, and being enhanced. And so a lot of the science that we have is very useful. That doesn't mean it's achieved perfect unity with the actual underlying phenomena that we observe, for whether it's the limitations of our measurement instruments, or I can't even measurementation.
Been a long day.
Just coining new words over here. Yeah. Or if it's just that we maybe don't have either the phenomena take too long, or they're constantly changing, so they're harder to observe, whatever it might be. It's just constantly changing. So there's not really this final certified complete stamp that you can ever put on math or science.
Do you think in theory there could be? Like, do you think there is, it's possible to reach a point like, okay, now we know everything? Or let me rephrase that. Maybe not so much know everything, like don't have it all, you know, cataloged in a book somewhere, but we've mastered all the formulae. We know how each phenomenon works, like on a fundamental level. So we could predict really anything we want, as long as we know how to put the pieces together, as far as, you know, which theories apply in a given scenario.
So I would put it this way. I think there are some things where we can understand enough to be highly accurate the vast majority of the time, right? Like, we understand enough about astrophysics to understand, you know, that a year is approximately 365 and a quarter days long, right? But the way that our math matches up with timekeeping, that's a little bit clunky, right? The theory doesn't quite match with the lived experience and of the passage of time. But I would say also, there are so many intersecting factors, both at a astronomically large scale and at a nanoscopically small scale, that we don't have the ability and probably never will to fully disentangle all of those overlapping effects, right? Just thinking about what could influence the movement of a single particle in an atom, or a single molecule in a fluid. There's so many different things that can affect that. And I don't know how we would plausibly create experiments that could isolate those single effects, right? Because to the point about the empirical nature is, we're constantly observing the superposition of all the combined effects at any scale, right? Whether they're at the astronomical scale or at the minutia. And we're just seeing a combined result of all those effects on whatever system we're observing. Mm-hmm. And so it's very hard to say, without being extremely careful to isolate variables, it's very hard to say that we could expect the same result. You know, for example, an experiment on Earth versus an experiment on the International Space Station. Those sorts of things are helpful, where you conduct the same experiment so you can kind of isolate what's maybe a result of doing something with gravity, or doing something that has less exposure to the sun's UV, or whatever it might be. not just UV, but radiation in general. But we don't often commit the resources necessary to isolate all those variables, right? To get to the pure model accurate science behind it. We get just enough to be useful on Earth, but it may not apply anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you bring up a good point, like the particles in a fluid, right? Like, you know, model what this one particular water molecule is going to do in this glass of water, right? So I think that's a good example of showing that there's actually two parts to this story. One of them is understanding all of the factors that influence the behavior you're trying to predict, right? You said, and you made a good point, that what we see at any given time in front of us is the combined effects, the superposition of every single factor that is actually in reality acting upon the thing that we're trying to observe, right? Like this water molecule in this glass. So one part of science is, can we figure out what all of those factors are? Can we actually figure out what all the factors, completely 100%, every single factor, can we accurately figure out what each of those are? That's question one. And then question two is, even if we can, like in the point of like a particular water molecule, we may understand. I think that's a good example to show the second part, actually, because there really isn't a lot of forces acting on that water molecule. There's gravity, there's friction, and what's what I'm looking for? Collisions, there we are, with the other water molecules around it. There's the van der Waals force, what with oxygen and hydrogen. And then surface tension. Yeah, if it's near the surface. You know, the amount of forces acting on it, or the amount of factors that are influencing its movement, I don't think it's that big of a list. And they're pretty simple, basic physics level stuff. But how do you properly capture all of the initial conditions? How do you properly capture, okay, we know what the factors are. We know that there's gravity. So how, you know, what's the effect of gravity? Well, that's pretty constant. We got a good idea of that. Okay, now how do you quantify the collisions that water molecule is experiencing right now? And I don't mean like the average, you know, somebody might say, oh, use the temperature and they'll give you like an average sense of what the collisions are. It's like, no, I'm talking about that particular water molecule 7,419,722, you know, that particular water molecule, what collisions is it experiencing right this moment? And somebody's going to probably, like, I would conclude, well, we can't know. Like, we know that those collisions are influencing it, and we know we can generalize how the collisions will affect it in a general sense. But, you know, did it just right now in this, you know, brief second experience, like, a collision from the left and a collision from the right, or two collisions from the left, or two from the top and one from the bottom? It's like, we can't really right now, like, determine that. So even though we may understand what the factors are, we have no way of actually measuring it. And that might become important. So what we can probably, what our next best thing is to just come up with a best guess of how, of not what the fact, not what the factor is, but basically what its measurement is, what its quantity is. That's our best guess. And that's what models do, right? You can determine the initial conditions. So you can say, for these initial conditions, you know, run the simulation. But in any given, you know, glass of water on your desk, you can't actually capture what those initial conditions are. So that shows, even if we do properly, completely understand what all the factors are, how do you know what values to plug in? Like, if we understand all the formulas, and have them written down and in an Excel spreadsheet and ready to hit enter, what numbers do you put into their variables? And that is the other side of science that we have to overcome. And sometimes it's not there.
Yeah. And I think that reminds me of a point I was going to make earlier when you introduced the topic, which is, even if we could derive models for any average situation, and even if you could capture the initial conditions, we live in a universe of losses, right? Of entropy, friction. So every scenario that you can observe or every interaction over the long term is also going to degrade in some way or change in some way, right? So maybe your model will be accurate for a long period of time, but you would have to account for that degradation as well.
That would be one of the factors. Because if you
Yeah,
don't
sure.
account for it, say, oh, all of a sudden our model is becoming less accurate more times. Okay, then you didn't account for all the factors.
Sure. But I think the other thing with that is that I think we often take mental shortcuts or psychological shortcuts, and we are encouraged to do that in how we are taught science. Well, let me elaborate here, because we are and we aren't. When we run experiments in a science class, for example, we can see that our results never quite match what the textbook shows, right? It's like if you're measuring how long it takes to melt tin or something, or whatever the experiment is, your experiment, no matter how closely you follow their example, is going to be slightly different because your conditions are slightly different. So you can see, okay, I understand the trends. I understand how they got where they did. My values are slightly different. But that's true like even for experiments that are run in highly controlled environments, the results are still variable. And when you get into things like social experiments or medical experiments or whatever it might be, where there are a bunch more factors that you can't properly isolate, the variability goes through the roof. And so it gets even harder to say anything about a specific member of a population, right? The average isn't really useful at all because you can have one individual in that population that's so far from the average or so far from that idealized theoretical calculation that even when you have the right inputs, it's hard to predict where they're going to go.
Well, and you brought up a point in a previous episode too that I think demonstrates why, assuming the average is representative, sometimes can just be the wholly wrong thing to do. In that, on average, or I should say, the average human has, one testicle, right?
Yes, one breast and one testicle.
Right. So now ask yourself, okay, how frequently, if you just take one person, pluck them out, and ask them how many breasts, how many testicles do you have? How often are you going to get the answer one of each? Even though that's the average, you will just about never get that answer. I mean, how, like,
Right.
one out of a million, if even that.
Yeah.
Now,
Yeah,
that's an extreme example of what we're talking about, but yeah, like some like the average is not always a good representation of what to expect.
that makes me think of a scenario in healthcare that's right at the nexus of this topic, which is BMI. It drives me nuts.
Body
So
mass
for the,
index.
yeah, body mass index. Yeah. So for those who aren't familiar, body mass index was developed by not a doctor or a nurse or someone studying physiology. It was developed by a mathematician in, I believe, the 1890s, who simply wanted to develop a relationship between height and weight.
So
And
not
so
even
that's.
not even like health. Or like, if you have too big of a BMI, then means you're fat and overweight. Like he wasn't even going for that. Or was he?
That may be possible behind the scenes. I'm not 100% sure, but he was essentially just trying to create a number that could describe a relationship between height and weight, some kind of a ratio between height and weight. And so that's all that BMI represents is a ratio between height and weight. So I will not argue at a large scale when we're talking about a modern population, a higher BMI in the, you know, what obese range or whatever you want to, healthcare wants to label it, is highly correlated with a number of health issues. So I won't say that it's a completely useless factor, but my argument would be that it's actually an oversimplification that can lead to false positives, in the sense that basically over-diagnosing ill health on people who are in perfectly good health. Mm-hmm. And my argument for that being, if you were to calculate the BMI for individuals who are professional athletes in just about any sport, a high percentage of them would be in the obese category. And so I think we owe it to ourselves to either find more useful measures like body fat percentage or something along those lines, or to reassess where those thresholds should reside from an actual health outcomes perspective. So if we're going to just do things empirically, then it's like, okay, let's set those thresholds at a location where they actually empirically result in negative healthcare outcomes. And I guess this is where my knowledge is a little bit lacking. Maybe they have been adjusted over time, but that's not my understanding. I don't think that they've changed.
The body mass index numbers, or like the threshold of, if you're above this number, you're unhealthy. That's what you're talking
right.
about?
Right, yeah. So for somebody in my height range, of like between 5'9 and 5'10, the ideal weight, I think, is like 155 pounds, according to BMI. Mm. And then if you get above like 170, you're considered overweight, and then over like 180 and you're obese, somewhere in that range.
Going from overweight to obese, like from basically going, oh, you're not overweight, to wow, you're obese, dude, that's a 10 pound difference.
It's not that much. I'm going to refrain from looking it up, so we're not diving into the Google search details here. But
Oh yeah.
It's pretty ridiculous when you look at how narrow the thresholds are, right? And part of the challenge is, or what my beef has been, is that people have different body structures just inherently. So if you're looking at an average across the whole population, it makes sense by and large. It's not totally unvaluable. But you have, especially people who are invested in athletics, tend to have more muscle mass. Mm-hmm. And so because muscle's more dense than fat, their BMI is heightened, you could argue inappropriately. So it's evaluating them as a higher risk for health issues because their weight to height ratio is skewed, as someone who has a higher body fat percentage that's less athletic, right?
Ooh, hold on. I think you just touched on an important point. Their BMI is not skewed or anything. It's that, like, their BMI is just what their BMI is. What the problem is when we're using BMI as we are to determine, oh, your BMI is high, therefore you are overweight or you're obese. That right. assumption that BMI is a good indicator of obesity is the problem, not BMI itself.
Sure. Yeah.
BMI is just a measurement of these two different things, basically just probably a weighted ratio, or one of them squared or cubed or something, whereas the other one isn't. How we interpret that is, I think, the problem. And you're saying us interpreting it as high BMI equals unhealthy. There's enough evidence to suggest that no, that assumption is incorrect.
Right. And where it becomes problematic is there are health insurance companies out there who will change your rate based on your BMI. They'll give you discounts if you have a lower BMI, et cetera. And it could actually be people who are very healthy and very active, taking care of themselves, working out regularly, et cetera, are actually paying higher rates because their BMI is the equivalent of someone who lives a sedentary lifestyle, but it's much less healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be a helpful diagnostic if you are looking at the habits and behaviors of the individual who it's measuring, right?
This is a good example of our original question. Like people trying to come up with what's a single metric, a single number that'll let us know if you're healthy versus unhealthy. At least, maybe not like, suffering from a disease or something that's more of a what's what I'm looking for? An invasive or a temporary illness, but just something like, are you generally healthy? And people
Sure.
are using, and the insurance companies in this example, or doctors, or just pop culture is using BMI as that metric because empirically that's been the closest thing we can come up with. So it's like, why hasn't medical science come up with a better way to determine health? Or if they have, why can't they find, maybe there is one out there, but it's just really hard to measure on a given person. Like theoretically, it's the perfect metric. Or if you can measure this number on a person, it's the perfect indicator of their health. But it's actually really hard to measure. Like you mentioned body fat percentage earlier. I think that would be a great metric to, maybe not a perfect one, but that might be a great metric to determine overall health. But body fat percentage is actually kind of tricky to measure. So sure, if we can somehow measure it, it would be great, but good luck measuring it.
3D scanners. Oh yeah.
I can't tell if you're being sarcastic or not.
Well, both. But I mean, the problem with body fat percentage today is that you essentially are doing some very rough math based on the circumference of body parts that are assumed to be cylindrical, and then adding that all up and using the density of different materials in your body to calculate body fat percentage.
Oh, and you know what? So that's a way. Another way, because I actually do this regularly. There's a like you can get like these caliper sorts of things, and you can basically measure like if you take like a chunk of your skin with the fat layer in it, and you kind of pinch it and measure it with the calipers, and get like you'll get a number for that part of your body, and then you do that in several parts of your body, and you put it into this formula, and that could calculate your body fat percentage. But if you look at the formula, it's the formula itself is one of those. I'm sure you remember, Ben, and anybody else who's been in engineering school, there are some formulas that certain sciences use, not because they've been theoretically derived, like force equals mass times, F equals ma, right? That is theoretically derived. But there are some formulas out there that are just like, look, we don't know all the factors that are playing into this, so we can't come up with a theoretical or a formula that's been theoretically derived to describe how this system works. What we did was we just took a bunch of data, plotted it on a graph, and we just worked tirelessly until we came up with a formula that, when you graph it, matches the data pretty closely. It doesn't actually tell you what's going on. It has nothing to do with how what's theoretically work going on behind the scenes. It's just when you put this formula on a graph, it correlates with the data close enough where let's just use that. And that's what you plug these caliper measurements in to determine your body fat percentage. And that's an example of what I'm talking about. Why hasn't there been a more theoretically derived way to easily measure body fat percentage? And the reason why we haven't is because we don't understand a way to measure or to determine body fat percentage. And it's like, that seems like, or at least we haven't found a way to determine it that's easily measurable. And it's like, have we really not come up with, like, we've sent men to the moon, we've sent space probes out of our solar system, we invented the atom bomb, we invented jets, all of that before computers. And we can't determine how to measure body fat percentage accurately? Like, really? Because it seems like it'd be have a lot of usage.
We could just shine a really bright light at somebody and then use what is it? Spectrometry?
Spectometry, maybe.
Spectrometry, whatever the word is. And
Spectrometry.
analyze the light coming through their body to determine what's fat and what's not. Problem solved. giant flashlight. Shine it in your stomach.
Just the stomach, because that's where all the fat congregates. Nowhere else.
Sounds like we're scientists from like the dark ages where
right.
You just whatever hairball theory you have, you just write it down like
let's bleed him. That will make him better.
The cheeks are the source of tears because that's where we observe them. There's little tear pouches in your cheeks. Where was I gonna say though? Body fat percent. Yeah, I think it's a fair point. Also, well, we're talking about why haven't we improved things in a really long time? Toilets. I would just like to say toilets in their current form have been around for super long time. We still have all sorts of problems with leaks and clogs and running water and cleaning, whatever other issues you want to throw on the list. And yet toilets haven't improved. Like, come on. We need to get some real brains on toilet engineering.
You know, it's funny you say that because there's a few different inventions, and I guess I never thought of the toilet as one of them, but maybe it is. There's a few inventions where they got it right really early on, and science or, you know, the industries have struggled to find a better way. And one of them is the internal combustion engine. It works pretty much theoretically, or I shouldn't say theoretically, the fundamentals are almost the exact same as they were 150 years ago. And sure, they've made improvements like, you know, let's use direct injection instead of a carburetor. But at the end of the day, in both cases, you're injecting a air fuel mixture into the cylinder. Like that fundamental operation has not changed. It's just your way of doing it has improved. But you're not changing, for example, like a good example of an innovation would be the difference between a gas and a diesel engine. Because sure, they do, they both inject a fuel. Well, that's the thing. They don't shoot a fuel-air mixture. They don't both shoot a fuel-air mixture into the cylinder. They do both get air and fuel into the cylinder, but they do it in two different ways that have pretty distinct results on the performance of the engine. So I would say those are, that's an innovation. They're different enough where, you know, one could be considered an improvement if it came along later. But ultimately, the internal combustion engine's the same as it has been for 150 years. And another one was the propeller. Propeller, the Wright brothers, two bicycle repair dudes from one of the Carolinas, just, you know, experimenting.
North Carolina, I believe.
Yeah, just experimenting out of their shop. No, as far as I'm aware, experience in aeronautical engineering. And even if they did, it would have been, you know, early 1900s era aeronautical engineering before flight was invented. So not a lot of knowledge going around. I don't know if it was by chance. I don't know if they were geniuses, like got 95% of where the propeller is today. And since then, people have not found a better way to design propellers.
So a couple of notes on propellers specifically and the Wright brothers. The Wright brothers were actually from Ohio, near Kettering, I believe, and they had a bike shop, which was where they had the components and stuff for the drive of the airplane. So they did their flight tests in the Carolinas, but they were from Ohio. The other thing was that I believe, and this actually connects the topic really well, incidentally, is that part of the reason that heavier than air flight had not been successful up until that point is that some of the pioneering work that had been done in terms of aerodynamics, especially pertaining to lift of wings, the guy who had done the research had, I think, either done it incorrectly, collected the data incorrectly, or modeled it incorrectly. I can't remember exactly what the details were, but they were able to actually do some of their own experiments and determined that this research that everyone in the industry was working off of was incorrect. And so they were able to make the corrections necessary to be able to figure out the actual optimal shape to generate the lift that they needed. And so that was what one of their major contributions was correcting the initial research that was bad. But the last point I wanted to make on that is I just saw a couple of weeks ago, I was watching a YouTube video about innovations that have happened in propellers just within the last couple of years, using toroidal propellers,
Yes, I just saw those rec I saw that recently too. That
which is pretty bonkers.
it is. So that so if you're listening, look up toroidal. How do you spell toroidal? T-O.
Toroidal,
Yeah.
Toroidal.
Yeah, it basically is like a tipless propeller. And if you're like, how does that work, then you can see the pictures. It's pretty cool. I think I'm going to try. I'm just going to avoid trying to describe it, because trying to describe those things in words would be weird. But yeah,
It's like,
I would
well,
say that's
you
an
could.
innovation in propellers. Like, that's probably the biggest innovation there has been in propellers since the Wright brothers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably true.
It's weird. And I want to make this point before I forget. It's like the Wright brothers, again, just two bicycle repair guys out of Ohio working on their own. They came up with a propeller design, and that propeller design was not really drastically improved upon. Like, so, different people came up with different refinements, saying, hey, if you tweak the design this way, you're making it better to do X, but it's a trade-off, so now it's worse at Y. Little refinements like that, but no real big major improvements or big breakthroughs, even through World War I, when the plane underwent an insane amount of development. World War II, when it went through another series of insane improvements, and all these people coming, going from biplanes to jet engines, going from dumb bombs to, guided missiles and A bombs, all within like a decade of each other. That much improvement was made in all those other systems. But the propeller, which they were trying to improve upon, the propeller, gosh darn it, they just couldn't do better than what the Wright brothers did, as hard as they tried. And it's just bonkers to me that they essentially outmatched an entire war-driven industry of, two warring sides who are desperately trying to outcompete one another and come up with better innovations. Even with all of those resources and all of that motivation, these two random guys from Ohio did a better job.
I think there's a couple of factors that play into that. The first thing I was going to say is for those who are still, if you're not going to look up what a toroidal propeller looks like, you can kind of imagine a pinwheel, only there's not a point on the end of it. It's just kind of a loop that connects back to the central spindle. That's kind of what they look like, is an open pinwheel. But the key finding with the toroids is that a lot of the inefficiencies of propellers come from the aerodynamic or hydrodynamic, if it's a propeller in water, vortices that are generated by the propeller tips. And so by instead of having a propeller that just hangs out in space and ends, if they wrap that back around and connect it to the propeller shaft, they remove that propeller tip and they then reduce all the turbulence, or not all, but a significant portion of the turbulence coming off the end of the propeller. So it makes them significantly quieter and more efficient. It's pretty fascinating, even if you don't know that much about propellers. I'm sure within the next few years, we're going to see them in a lot of places, on drones, airplanes, boats. It's a game changer from what I've heard. But the other point I was going to make is that I think there's also an element of anchoring, where the first person to get there sets the standard for performance. And then everyone else sets about trying to replicate what they did. And pretty soon you end up with an industry that is oriented around producing things of that type. And so it's not to say that you couldn't develop alternatives. It's just that alternatives are more expensive. There's less incentive to experiment with things that are drastically different because they're so expensive. And so I think certainly there are some instances, like with a propeller or internal combustion engine, where the original concept was pretty darn great. But I think it's also just a tendency to of people to leverage an existing successful design and improve it rather than go out and start from scratch.
Sure. And I think a big factor in that is like, why reinvent the wheel, right? If we have an internal combustion engine and we know what it can do and we know it's good enough, why bother coming up with a new one? Same thing with the propeller. But the thing is, they did do that. They did go against that theorem in a lot of other different fields. And I'm guessing, and I shouldn't say I'm guessing, I know like for the internal combustion engine, they did. People have tried to come up with big breakthrough differences. But every single one, except for the jet engine does have, that's an example, right? There's no pistons. It still uses combustion and it uses the intake compression, combustion and, you know, exhaust points of the engine stages, but it does so in a drastically different way to the point that, yeah, this is not a piston driven engine anymore. It's not like they just kind of took the piston engine and tweaked it. It's like, this is a whole new monster. They did try doing that with different technologies and just every single time, nope, it's not as good as the internal combustion engine with a, you know, standard V engine or inline engine or something. With pistons, that just has always been better, except for the jet. The jet is one where it was good enough to warrant its own applications.
I think
with propellers they did too. I'm not as privy to that as
I think part of it though is
real quick. Flying craft, right? They started with airplanes, you know, where you have a propeller pushing you or pulling you, and you have wings to generate lift. Then they came up with helicopters. That's another flying craft that is what I would say is a, you know, that's a whole new monster. That's not just a plane that's been modified. That's a whole new thing where somebody said, let's reinvent the wheel of how we fly.
Yeah, it's not a fixed wing aircraft.
So airplane to helicopter, piston engine to jet, you know, those are examples of what you just said, right, where they actually did break away and reinvent the wheel. And there are instances where they did try to do that other times, and it always just kept failing. And so that's why the Wright brothers propeller and why the internal combustion engine from like the 1850s is still around, because nobody, despite as much as they've tried, haven't come up with anything better.
So I think in general I agree with your assessment, but I would also say, going back to the other point that I made, that there's a tendency to abandon alternatives early when you have a successful established concept. So if I'm working on a rotary engine, for example, and it's, you know, there's already 30 years of R&D that have gone into a standard piston engine, they've got 30 years of incremental enhancements that maybe the rotary engine is as good as the piston engine is to begin with, but it's not as good as the piston plus 30 years of incremental enhancements. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you really, if you're proposing an alternative, essentially has to be a game changer that can overcome all the incremental enhancements that have happened to the technology since it was developed. Because people aren't going to really give you the benefit of the doubt to say, okay, you know, we'll give you another 30 years with this prototype to try to match the performance of where we're at today or surpass it, right? So it's, I guess I would say this, the economics of invention favor alternatives that are either very incremental or game changers that strike on some new physics. There's not really an in-between that's successful.
Yeah, I 100% agree that if there's an established technology, trying to come up with a groundbreaking reinvention of the wheel to do more or less the same thing, that is at a disadvantage. Because again, why reinvent the wheel if what we have is good enough? Right. And, you know, obviously using a design that already exists, you know, using an internal combustion engine for your aircraft is a lot easier than saying, let's develop a jet turbine to power our aircraft. Because that's a long uphill battle. You have a lot of R&D, you have a lot of development, you have a lot of testing, you have a lot of, you know, trial and error. And that's going to discourage you from using that and just say, well, let's just use the thing we already know. Because we don't have time to reinvent the wheel. We'll just use what we got. So it's definitely 100% at a disadvantage.
And I think the only reason that the jet engine became as prevalent as it did was because of the wartime necessity of establishing air dominance, right? And so at that point in time, it was almost not a matter of cost anymore. It was, this can perform better in this specific instance where we need it to. And so we're going to pay whatever it takes to get there.
Right.
It may have taken significantly longer or never happened at all if it was only based on commercial viability.
Yeah, because that in that case, they knew that they knew the limits of their current technology, propeller-driven aircraft, and it's related to the speed of sound. And once propellers start reaching the speed of sound, their performance, bad things start to happen. So if you want an aircraft to go as fast as the speed of sound, you got to come up with a new propulsion system. Well, they knew that jet engines, which I think had been demonstrated in laboratories like it's in the early 30s. So everybody knew that they were a viable thing. They just needed to be developed so that they could be suitably used on an aircraft. So that was a case where everybody realized that, hey, what we have isn't going to cut it. We do need groundbreaking stuff. And it's sort of the better of both worlds because it had already been demonstrated well enough for them to not have to reinvent the wheel because somebody else, some guy in some lab had reinvented the wheel. He did all the hard work of figuring out, hey, you can, you know, right. Just take a shaft with blades and, you know, you don't have to have any pistons. And he did all the hard work. He described how it happened. Then all these aircraft development companies and government agencies realized, okay, let's take all this development work that somebody else did, copy and paste it into our designs and just sort of tweak it a little bit so it fits and doesn't break down and is resilient enough. And, you know, even they were, you know, like a cloud, right? A cloud forming needs something to latch onto, but then it can form. So that's what they were like. They just latched onto this idea that somebody else came up with and then developed it from there. And that's why people like, or companies and organizations like, it ties back to what we already said. It's a lot easier to just keep developing and like something that you already know than trying to reinvent it. Because you don't know, right? You know a piston engine or this particular propeller is going to do, you know what it's going to do. You don't know that if you try to reinvent the wheel, try to come up with a whole new design, come up with a prototype, do your testing, it may just fall flat on its face. And you just wasted all that time and money for nothing. But you know that's not going to be the case if you use established technology.
So I think that kind of gets at one of the other topics that we'd highlighted, which is both the power and limitation of science being empirically based. And I think one of the massive limitations of science is that it's completely dependent on observation, right? Mm-hmm. And especially because we don't often truly understand the full spectrum of parameters involved from a physics perspective of the phenomena that we can observe, we are stuck doing incremental changes. So it's like, you know, you're talking about 150 years plus of development on the internal combustion engine. How many, this is just a question I'm curious about, how many dollars over that span and man hours have been invested in incremental enhancements to internal combustion engines? I mean,
a lot.
An astronomical number, right? Like, I think we'd all be blown away if we actually saw what that total was. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot of that is because we only have, I'll say even now after 150 years of research, we still don't have a fully comprehensive physics model for everything that's happening or for a way to, proactively optimize combustion parameters to develop a different technology. Mm. And so thinking about that similarly, like from a anthropology or archaeological or geological perspective, we can make a lot of hypotheses about what's happened in the past based on what we can observe today. But in many cases, we're limited to 150 years worth of observations. And then we essentially are extrapolating those trends across a data set that's far longer. And so our observation period represents just a tiny fraction of what could have been observed if we were around. And so we can assume that the conditions we find things today represents what they were in the past, but we don't really know that. And so there's a lot of assumptions built into the methodologies that we use. And that's just one simple example that a lot of people are familiar with, but that's true across many, many fields where, again, it's that guess and check, incremental improvement. And I think of particular challenge, going back to your original topic of human health, is just the ethics of it, right? We don't necessarily think it's a good thing to tear someone apart and really get into the theory of how their system works, or to try and derive more theoretical based understanding from it. So we're kind of stuck in this thing where it's like, well, we don't really want to be invasive, or we don't really want to do the best, I'll call it raw science that we can do, because it comes at the harm of the individuals who would be studied.
I'm sure there's plenty of different things we could find out without harming people, though. Or, but that's the thing, right? Why do we even need to do these invasive procedures and d diving in? Like, it seems like, and I'm not saying that we should know everything about the human body. It just seems like, how we, how a certain diet should affect a certain person or whatnot should be better understood at this point. Because a lot of that's chemistry.
I think a lot of that is going to come in the next few years, right? We've seen this explosion of wearable fitness gear. So we're going to start to have large data sets that can connect things like heart rate, blood pressure, activity levels, diet, all those sorts of things. People are voluntarily providing that information that can be aggregated to provide, at a very high level, some pretty strong connections, I think, between specific behaviors. But again, that's empirically based, but I think it'll be at a scope where the empirical data set is large enough that we can actually derive theoretical models that are valid. But not being a healthcare professional or someone who spends a lot of time on that, maybe that's an oversimplification.
Yeah, but that's science in general, oversimplifying things.
Well,
And
simplifying, we don't necessarily always know if it's oversimplified or not.
I think you made a point earlier that I really wanted to make sure that we walk away with, which is a lot of our models, a lot of our understanding, or not mo like, we derive models, simulations, formulas, just based off of empirical data, where we're seeing the data and we're just fitting equations to it, where it's like that's good enough. If you were ever taking like a math class, what's it called? Like Newtonian approximations. Do you remember those? I may not be calling it by the right name.
I was thinking of approximations earlier from like Calc 2, but I don't remember what their name was. I feel like it
Yeah.
was a different mathematician, but
Or
anyway.
maybe Newton's method might be a way of approximating.
Sure, yeah.
But that's a great example of, okay, we don't know the theoretically what's going on, but we're going to come up with this empirically derived formula that's close enough, but it doesn't actually describe theoretically what's going on.
Right. Which was infuriating for me in a mathematical sense. But in a day-to-day sense, it's like, well, if it gets me the answer that I need and I can rely on it, do I really necessarily care if I don't understand what's happening behind the scenes, right? You probably don't care until it becomes unreliable, and then you care a lot. But like we don't know, like, if you don't understand the physics, you don't know where that tipping point is and when it's going to become unreliable. So it just catches you by surprise and you're like, well, crap.
Right, like these approximations usually only work within a certain range, right? Like, you know, where x is 0 to 5 or something. So if you use it to tell you what happens when x equals 10 and you don't really realize that the formula isn't meant to apply out that far, you're going to get some really wacky answer.
Right. I remember one of the keys to that was you had to have a quote unquote reasonable guess to start the process, or you were not going to get anything close to the right answer. That was the other thing. So going back to what we were talking about of being able to identify and quantify all the different parameters that might affect, say, the movement of a molecule of water in a glass. So I think even if we could, like, we could peel back the physical layer of the universe and see just like if we had eyes to see physics, and so we could see like the every factor perfectly that was impacting it, I think there would be an extent to where in the conditions that we can observe the universe on Earth today, there are, we'll say, 3 to 5 factors in any given situation that control or, you know, dominate, let's say, 95% of the behavior that we can observe. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's 30 factors in total, but those other 25 factors contribute to such a small percentage that for the purposes we need, understanding the 3 to 5 factors is sufficient, because it gets us where we want to go. And so it doesn't really matter what happens with those other 25 factors, because there's such a small contribution to the overall result.
Yeah, it's the 80-20 rule, right? Just accounting for 20% of the factors gets you 80% accuracy.
Right.
You know, just as an example. But it's like, okay, do you really want to do... So if you only do 20% of the work, right, that means that you still have... You only did 1/5. So you could have to do 4 times more work than you've already done. 4 times more. So let's say you get something done in 10 hours. Well, maybe you need to put an extra 40 hours in just to get an extra quarter way out, going from 80% to 100%, doing an extra 20%. You've already done 80. So 20 divided by 80 is, you know, a quarter.
And it's probably more of like a factorial situation or exponential, where you put in 40 more hours of work and you get 80% of the way from 80% to 100%, right?
Right. So
you get to like 96%. Yeah. And then you put in 160 hours and you get to 8.something%.
And just in case, I don't know if there's anybody who's listening who isn't really keeping track of the numbers. Let me put it this way. How about this? Ben, I will give you... Let me see. How do I want to do this? I'll give you $1,000. No, excuse me. I'll give you $800 to do 10 hours of work for me. Or I'll give you $1,000 to do 40 hours of work for me.
Wow. When you put it that way, I'll do the 10 hours of work, please.
Yeah, I mean, if we got paid that way, like, think about this, right? You get 10, if you get 80% of your paycheck for one day of work on a Monday, right? You worked Monday, you get 80% of your paycheck, and you have to work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday just to get the last 20%. How many people do you think would work the full work week?
Right. Yeah. I think we would all work Mondays and just be like, deuces.
Or we would just moonlight a second job on Tuesday.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a good example. That's a very concise way of putting it, I think.
Yeah.
And tying it back to what we were talking about earlier, I think that highlights in some really lucky instances, like internal combustion engine or propeller, whatever example you want to pick, where the 80-20 rule is actually more like 95-5 or something like that, where you just luck into something that's so close to optimal for the use with very little effort, and then you just spend inordinate amounts of time trying to eke the last little bit out of it.
Yep. And I would say that's technology. Like, I would 100% agree that's what happened with the internal combustion engine. Because again, it's remained fundamentally the same as it has since the 1850s. And all the development work, or most of it, for 150 years, and that's, as you said before, that's a lot of man hours, that's a lot of money, has gone just to eke, a little bit more efficiency out of it, a little more power, a little less weight, a little more reliability.
So on the flip side of that, because I don't want to discount all the effort that's been put in, because I think we've spent a lot of time this episode doing that. If you look at, so for example, the John Deere Tractor and Engine Museum in Waterloo has super old school, like belt driven engines. I think they're kerosene traction engines.
Okay.
They're basically like generators back in the late 1800s or early 1900s. And they have one that is the size of, I want to say it's like the size of a minivan, and it generated like 5 or 10 horsepower in total. Whereas now, if you look at something like Formula One, they're getting 1200 horsepower out of an engine that is, I don't know, the size of a suitcase or something like that. I don't know the exact dimensions, but significantly smaller. So while they got the fundamental principles very right, the optimization of the input parameters, there's still a significant amount of tweaking that's been done to develop vastly more efficient and more powerful outcomes. There was one other thing that I wanted to highlight. What were we talking about right before I went on that sidebar?
Oh shoot, I can't remember. Oh, little Sadie. She's just a dog.
I don't know why she's barking. It must mean Liz is home. Shoot, it was something about stumbling onto
Oh, while you
an
think that,
optimal.
everybody
I remember.
listening, okay, keep
Go
do
ahead, go ahead.
cross your fingers so you remember.
Yeah.
In case anybody kind of noticed anything fishy right there, so Ben and his wife Sarah live with his with Sarah's younger sister, or I should say she lives with them. So Sarah's her. I was just thinking, like, if somebody didn't know. Like that situation, and you talk about Sarah, then she's, oh, Liz is home. It's like, what's going on? Like, sounds a little fishy
Yes.
here.
Yeah. Yes. So Liz is our Sarah's sister, also our roommate, and Sadie barks when she comes home.
Oh,
Technically,
little
Sadie barks when
Sadie.
anyone enters the house, but I feel like, except probably if it was an intruder, if it was somebody breaking in, she'd be quiet. But everybody that she cares about or comes through the door, then she would bark at.
So she only
Okay.
sounds the alarm when it's somebody that you have no concern about.
Correct. Yes.
Great job, Sadie.
So the thing that I was going to say is that I think part of, for the internal combustion engine, part of what its staying power has been is that the fuel source has an incredibly high power density. So that the potential energy of fossil fuels is incomprehensible, I would just say, like on a day-to-day basis. Sure, we can quantify it with science. I don't think most of us have any concept of what that actually means in terms of the potential energy in a gallon of gasoline.
Right. Well, and it's not internal, it's just combustion engines in general. Because you can have, so like jets, piston engines, you can have external combustion engines, such as a steam engine. A steam engine is an external combustion engine. Fun fact. Anyway, please continue.
So my first point was this: the staying power and what made it so successful was the density of the fuel, or the power density of the fuel, and secondarily is the power density of the mechanism responsible for converting potential energy to mechanical energy.
Right.
I think those two factors are what have given combustion engines their longevity and utility.
Yes, 100% agree.
And that's part of the challenge facing the world today, trying to implement electric vehicles, is that we can't get that batteries are not nearly as efficient of an energy storage device as a gallon of gasoline. That's or just reality
dense,
today.
Energy dense a source.
Sure,
of energy.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, energy so storage
space for, or energy per unit volume is incredibly high in fossil fuels.
Yep. Not as high, not anywhere near as high as nuclear fuel. There was
also true.
There was a story of a U.S. It was either a nuclear sub. I think it was an aircraft carrier. I think it was a Ronald Reagan class, or Nimitz class, maybe. Aircraft, so the giant, like the floating cities, and it was given 20 pounds of fuel, and it was supposed to last like 10 or 20 years, and they reached the end of that service life and they still had half of it left.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah, a 20, so you know, pick up a 20 pound dumbbell or like a bag of cat kitty litter, imagine that weight of something fueling a city for 20 years.
Not just a city, but a city that weighs over 100,000 tons and can move through the ocean in excess of like 35 or 40 knots.
Can aircraft carriers move that fast?
Yes.
Dang.
The numbers are ridiculous how fast they can move at full throttle. Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, to that point, I really feel like certainly nuclear comes with its own set of problems, like disposing of the waste and, you know, needing to have a lot of redundancies for potential failures. But I think it's unfortunate that the technology experienced some very visible public failures in its infancy.
Yeah,
because I feel like, there's so much potential there in terms of long-term energy source that can be stable and controlled with a very known contained byproducts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we aren't really able to tap into that because people are so scared of what might happen.
Well, I think it's not just the fear of what could happen. I think it's like if you're using fission to fuel the nuclear reactor, then you have to worry about waste. You have to worry about mining and processing the fuel before you can even use it. And then you use it and then you have to dispose of the waste, and that's dangerous. Fusion would be a much better way of doing it all around. I'm not sure if fusion now. So nuclear fuel has, bar none, the best energy density fuel source. Energy storage, not a problem whatsoever for nuclear fuel. However, it loses out on the energy conversion device. So a piston engine doesn't generate energy. All it does is it converts chemical energy to mechanical energy. That's all it does, or mechanical work. It doesn't actually generate power. The gas in the tank does.
Yeah.
Or I should say it just converts the power from chemical potential energy to mechanical work.
So
a nuclear reactor is what converts nuclear energy to mechanical work or heat or electrical, you know, energy. But the devices that can make that do the conversion are ginormous because they have to be.
Well, do they have to be, or is it because we have wanted their use to be limited to very controlled, highly secured areas that don't move around, that can be highly shielded?
Right now they're too big to fit in a car. You can't power a car off of a nuclear fuel. You can power now if you make the vehicle big enough, then you can, like a nuclear sub or an aircraft carrier, but they need to be big enough to house the reactor.
I would say in general, I don't think our government or really any governments really want automotive manufacturers, for example, to be able to have access to nuclear fuel sources, right? It's like they want nuclear fuel in as few hands as possible. And so ensuring it doesn't make it to automotive or vehicular manufacturers is one way of doing that.
Well, even if they could, right? I'm guessing even if they allowed automakers to make automatic or nuclear powered cars, we'd run into a fuel source problem.
Yeah, there probably won't be enough fuel
around. And it would be actually weird, right? Because we just described how a giant floating city of an aircraft carrier, it used 10 pounds of fuel in like one or two decades, right? So just a commuter car is going to use like a little grain of sand's worth of fuel over like its whole lifetime.
Right.
So
and
selling and handling fuel that small would have its own problems too. Like the
weird part would be that you could just park your car and then plug it into your house to like power your house too and take some load off the grid. Because your nuclear reactor is just going to keep churning away unless you decided to. I don't think it makes sense to like slow down the reaction.
No, I think you can. I think you could turn a nuclear reactor off, can't you? You have to be able to do that.
But you'd have to have some way to restart it then. I think you can shut it off, but I don't know that you have a way to restart it without some special equipment.
Oh, well, yeah. But I mean, like, I think reactors.
You could throttle it way down, sure.
But hold on. So you raise a good point. Like if you wanted to use it to power your car so you can drive point A to point B and then plug into your house, now the vehicle has to have a way to convert nuclear energy into one, mechanical work, and then two, electrical energy. Now, it kind of already has to do that because it has to power its own electrical system. But, you know, a house requires much more electricity than a car. So you'd have to really oversize its electrical capacity, you know, or something.
Yeah, I wasn't saying that it would power your entire house, but it could supplement, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's already been discussions of doing that with battery electric vehicles and power outages and things of that nature. But
wait a minute. If you're using your for power outages. Okay, I was going to say, what's the point of plugging your car into your house if you're just going to have to drain the battery and then plug your house into your, you know what I mean? Just plug it back in and then use power from the grid to recharge it anyway.
No, yeah, I was. There have been discussions about, like, I think in California, about laws where it would be mandatory to register your electric car with utility or something, such that in emergency situations you'd be required to have it hooked up, and then they could drain the battery to use it to power the grid.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. Why would
just like the city sends people out to your house to siphon gas out of your car, you know, during
right
news.
Yep. Yeah. That happens to me all the time.
I'm sure
all of our listeners would be familiar with that scenario as well.
Before we wrap up here, I wanted to add a couple other things that I was thinking about related to power density. And one of them is similar to the example you gave about the aircraft carrier and how it used less than what they had planned for its service life. The Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 probes are actually still active. Or at least Voyager 2 is approaching 50 years old.
Okay, I was going to ask. Dang, they're old. Holy cow.
Yeah, and so they operate, their engines or their power source is actually uses the thermal energy generated by radioactive decay of some plutonium isotope, I can't remember which one. And they built the systems robustly enough and provided enough fuel that the fuel has outlasted, I think their original target life was like 10 or 20 years, or maybe not even that long, maybe it was like a couple of years, approaching 50 years old, and they're still communicating with receivers on Earth as they, you know, they've left the solar system. And by that, I mean, they've exited the heliosphere into like intergalactic space. But NASA is actually slowly turning off instruments to conserve more power and keep them alive, like the instruments that they care most about, to keep them alive for even a few years longer.
I heard about that.
But it's just pretty crazy how the longevity of those systems based on the fuel density that they had. The other thing I was going to mention is that I think what we were talking about with the relationship of not just the energy density of the fuel source, but also the conversion mechanism.
Yeah.
That those two parameters have to be optimized for vehicles, for example, right? So what you were talking about, the power density of nuclear fuel is great, but the conversion density of the mechanism is not. So even though the power supply is super dense, the conversion mechanism isn't. So it's not a great solution for mobile equipment or vehicles in general, right? And that's where, you know, you see coal power plants or wind turbines or whatever. Those sorts of solutions work great in stationary applications, and wind turbines are slightly different, I recognize. But the internal combustion engine just happens to have a really great ratio where both the fuel supply and the conversion mechanism happen to be very dense in relative terms to the other sources available.
Right. And I think steam engines, that because you were saying coal, right? And I was like, think, well, they did have coal power cars and vehicles for a little bit. But
then
the internal combustion engine came around. It was way better because you don't need this giant boiler filled with water and, you know, cast iron, super heavy. Along with the power. So not only is the conversion mechanism a lot heavier, it's a lot less powered. It can only convert energy so fast. So its power is pretty low. That's the other thing, too, right? It's conversion. It's the size and weight of the conversion mechanism and the rate at which it can convert the power. That's another thing that internal combustion engines are really good at, is they can convert a lot of power or a lot of energy really quickly. They have great conversion power levels. A electric motor, I think, is also pretty good up there.
The battery may not be though.
Battery is another topic, but continue.
Yeah. No, it just got me thinking. I was reading a little bit about combustion engines before and about how in the 1800s they experimented with explosive dusts of different kinds.
Yep. I saw that on Mythbusters a long time ago, even.
I was just wondering, like, if we had found a good way to, like, powder, create coal powder that could then be fed in. Almost aerosolized and mixed with air. You know what I mean? If that could have been a more effective competitor with diesel or gasoline. Because part of that is just the ease of transferring the fuel, right, from storage into the combustion process is another element that's a win for that system.
I doubt it would work for diesel because you need really stupid high fuel pressure to spit the fuel in there fast, to one, spit it in there fast enough, because you got like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second to do it. And at least for the diesel fuel, because it's a liquid, the higher the pressure, the more it vaporizes and like aerosols in and all the molecules separate out. If you have really low fuel pressure, then the jets, like, really, it's like a stream, so it doesn't burn very well because only like the outer surface of the stream gets contact with air. And so I'm not sure how well a solid fuel would work, but obviously it didn't work because there was like no active applications that used it.
Yeah. Assuming that they explored that, which presumably they did, but don't necessarily know.
Right.
Well, we didn't get to all the topics that we had thought connected here, which is fine because I expected that would probably be a multi-parter. But we are closing in on an hour 20 here, so I think it's probably time to wrap up this episode, give our listeners a break, and
nice.
Invite them again, as always, share your thoughts on this topic, especially because we may have an extension. So if there's things that you would like to hear that you don't think we covered or additional thoughts that it sparked for you, we'd love to hear those. Maybe we can work those into the next episode. And again, we've been putting the sign up to be a guest on the podcast with us in the episode descriptions. So as you're listening to an episode, if you're like, hey, I'd like to be a part of one of these conversations, or you have an idea of what a good topic would be, Feel free to just click that link and submit your information.
And I was thinking maybe if you do want to submit an idea, maybe because they can, you said they could see our current list, right, Ben? Is that accurate?
I don't, they can see the sign up. I don't think they can see who has filled it out in the past.
Oh, I see. Okay. Never mind. I was going to say, but I will say, if you want us to talk about a topic, just be, I guess, descriptive enough. So give us some direction. Because we want to make sure we're not just like we go off in a completely different direction than what you wanted right off the bat and don't really cover it. I can see that happening. So more details, the better. And the more details you give, the more ideas it'll put in our heads as to what, you know, points can we can talk about.
Correct. Lots of different directions to jump off from.
Right. So, for example, we have a topic on our own topic list that just says Fibonacci sequence. And that's from years ago. And it's like, we can't remember. We can't remember what we meant by that. So now we kind of don't talk about it because we don't really have the direction. It's like, yep, it's a series of numbers. All right. I mean, I'm sure we could really get talking on it, but I'm guessing we jotted it down because we had a really cool point about it in mind. But now we've lost what that is. And
I think that topic, as well as infinity paradoxes, were on our original list from like 2019. And I remember talking about them at the time and having a direction for it. And then through iterations of the list and, you know, time, COVID, et cetera, I have since lost the context of the significance of those.
For the infinity paradoxes, I put that one on there and I am still very interested in doing it. And I know what direction I want to go in. I just, that one's going to require some homework on both of our parts, like just looking up some videos so you can kind of get the background into what I particularly wanted to, what I want to dive into particularly about infinity paradoxes. But
gotcha.
I don't want to give away any more than that.
So should I delete Fibonacci sequence then?
I think it's time to kill it.
Okay. Goodbye.
Let's get, it's can gone. We get taps playing? I need to put taps on my soundboard. I think all I got is this.
That's a lot of nuts.
That's mournful enough, right?
Baba Booey.
I don't have Baba Boo anymore.
Oh,
I got rid of it. I know. That was a special entry.
Sad day, but
indeed,
such is life. Okay. Well, thanks for sticking around with us through the tangents and bangents. And we'll talk to you next time. Take care.
Ba-na-na-na-na-na, na, Neo. Ba-na-na-na-na-na-na, na, 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 sporing. Be-ne-ne-ne.